from Vision Australia Radio. It's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, I'm Michael Hintz, the lovely voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine. We're on Vision Australia Radio, of course, and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. Great to be with you again, and as the great man Len Evans used to say, life's too short to drink bad wine. Hear, hear. And it's hello from my producer, looking $1 million today. You lost a bit of weight, Tristan Hodson. So much for autumn. 'Tis the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness. Talk about an Indian summer last week. Holy moly. First, before I introduce my guest, my wine of the week for this week is a Piano Piano. It's Slowly Slowly. 2012 Sophie's Block Chardonnay. 13% alcohol by volume, screw cap seal. Made by the talented Mark Scalzo in what I call the dress circle of Victoria's northeast. That's Beechworth. Golden to the eye, its bouquet of peaches and honey morphs into a palette of citrus with some stone fruit and cashew. It has a rich, creamy textural mouthfeel with a long aftertaste of more peach, honey and roasted almonds. An excellent Chardonnay of balance, complexity and length, made from a vineyard almost adjoining Gioconda's, but not at the same price as Gioconda, need I say more. Now, my guest today is vigneron, one-time sparky, restaurant reviewer, father, avid angler, man of words, storyteller, and author. Gee, you need a drink after an introduction like that. The intrepid, indefatigable, indestructible Graham Leith from Passing Clouds at Musk near Daylesford. Graham is resilience personified as he relocated Passing Clouds, all 16 semi-trailer loads of it, from its original home in King Gower, north of Bendigo, to the more temperate climes of Musk. And you're saying, where's Musk? Musk's very near Daylesford. To say he's led a full life is an understatement. Last year, he published his memoir in a book titled Passing Clouds, A Winemaker's Journey, published by the august publisher, and it is, it's a good imprint, Long Light, Allen and Unwin. Graham, welcome to Grapevine.
Thank you, Michael. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. Or should I say welcome, Mr. Grenache or Greville Nash or Ezekiel Kearney or Zucchini, some of the names you used to go under, your pseudonyms. It's a long time since we first met when I visited King Gower in the early 80s. Firstly, what led you to write A Winemaker's Journey?
I think, Michael, so many people would say when I'd be relating stories about what happened then and what happened then and that vintage and so on, people would say, you ought to write a book about that. And after a while, I realised no one else was going to write a book about me, so on my story, so I decided to do it myself. And I was fortunate to get a publisher. My agent got a publisher, and that was good. I had written a couple of little things before, children's book and a gardening book. And a
How to Plant a Vineyard book.
Yeah, yes. By Grenville Nash.
Grenville Nash, yes.
It's interesting. Some people, occasionally somebody would come up to the vineyard, they'd ask me questions about planting. A couple of times they had the Grenville Nash book in their glove box.
Really?
And took it out and I said, oh, well, take notice of that. That Grenville Nash is a smart bloke. Everything in that will be right. And one bloke 2 years later rang up and said, you bastard, you're Grenville Nash.
Yeah. Now, your books are candid, no-holes-barred, gutsy, forthright, what other term could I use, boots and all, insight into a life crammed full of ups and downs, dogged determination, sheer hard yakka, tribulations, tragedy, triumph, heartbreak, humour, and above all, unquenchable optimism. So it's suffice to say you've led a pretty full life, haven't you, Graham? And winemaking's only part of it, albeit an important part.
I'd have had a much better life if I hadn't been working all the time.
Yes, yes. Work is inconvenient at times,
that's
isn't
it? It is. It interferes with trout fishing and golf and everything.
Ah, I didn't know you played golf.
I don't very much.
That's a nice little course up at Hepburn Springs, isn't it? Yeah, with the kangaroos bounding across. I think the only hole I can hit there, I think, is the first, because it's downhill and the ball dribbles a fair way.
But yeah, if you hit it hard, you can hit the trees either side too.
Yep. I imagine writing such a book would be a cathartic experience. With the benefit of hindsight, what did you learn about yourself? Now that the book's out and a year old, what did you learn about Graham Leith that you didn't know before you wrote the book?
I don't think anything I didn't know. Now, of course, there's a chapter about my daughter's death and the related circumstances. That was very hard. I didn't want to do that, but the publishers pointed out that I had to do that. So I had to face up to that. So it was very difficult. I wouldn't say it was cathartic either. It was just... it made me relive a lot of the stuff I had put out of my mind, like the court cases and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the most challenging part of it. But for the rest of it, it was I found it quite enjoyable. And I had a lovely lady who was helping me with the...
A good editor, in other
editing.
Words.
Yeah.
That makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, she'd say, well, you haven't written about... Your father. You should write about your father. So I write about my father, and she said, well, you've written about your father, but you haven't written about your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took me back a bit, and that was very rewarding. It was good to revisit old times, because my father died when he was very young and I was 13.
Mm.
And poor old mum had a very tough life because she was left a widow with five children at age of about 38 or something, and then had to raise five children. Then her mother developed dementia, so she came to live with us. And then her mother decided that Mavis was poisoning her food, and so she had these terrible things to go through and no real company.
Yeah.
I'm increasingly aware of that when I, for instance, just this morning I threw some clothes in the dishwasher and I thought, in the clothes washer,
yep.
I thought, we have dishwashers and clothes washers,
mm-hmm.
but Mum used to, you know, they all used to boil the copper and use that big pole and put the velvet soap in and labour away. And that was to wash clothes for five children.
Ooh, yeah.
Fantastic, really.
Mm. Is there anything... you've left unsaid in the book that on reflection you think should have gone in?
Anything I've left unsaid?
Mm.
Yeah, quite a few things. They will remain unsaid.
They'll remain unsaid, yeah, because it's an exercise. It's an interesting exercise, you should imagine. Conversely, is there anything in the book that should have been left out, perhaps? It would have been better.
I don't think so.
No, so you've got it right, in other words.
I think so. Well, I had the two... women who were my editors, and they gave me excellent advice, I think. There's not very much, I can't think of anything they asked me to leave out, but they certainly encouraged me to add quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, yours is, forgive me for saying this, a restless soul in a way, because this is what I get from the book. I get a lot of energy, but I also get a restless spirit. Now that the book is written, done and dusted, is your spirit somewhat rested? Have the demons been put to rest, and are you more at peace with yourself? Because it's a fairly poignant account that the book at times gets...
No, I'm not one of those people who's at peace with themselves and probably never will be. But I'm heavily into another project now, which is a screenplay.
Oh, right.
Which is about, it's based on the wine industry, and it's got lots of skullduggery and sex and love and murder. And
in the wine industry?
In the wine industry. You'd be surprised how I kill off two people in the wine industry.
And is this play going to be performed when or what?
No, well, I'm hoping it's a screenplay.
Oh, it's a screenplay,
but
right.
I've overwritten it.
Yes.
And I'm now in the process of reducing it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very difficult because I put a lot of care and thought into a lot of the a lot of the lines, for instance, but I've got to take a lot of the, I've taken a lot of the lines out already.
Yeah.
And I've got to go through it again and shorten it. It's still too long. I've got to take about another sixth out of it.
And is this going to appear as, you know, in a tangible form somewhere down the track, or?
Oh, well, it'll be given to a producer to see if it can be good for television. Yeah. Everybody who's read it, people in the trades, think it's, including a couple of screenplay writers, say it's a terrific story. Keep at it, but you've just got to pare it down.
Now, you got your passion from words from a very early age. You were a vociferous reader. Is that true?
Yes.
I mean, you're quoting Oscar Wilde, Edgar Poe, quite a few. So this came from very early on in childhood, did it?
Yep. I think Mum taught us to read before we went to school, so I jumped a grade.
Yep.
Because I could already read and add up, so I jumped first grade and went straight into second grade, which meant I was always the youngest person in the class.
Yes.
So when I got to Northcote High, I was the youngest. I was the only 11-year-old, I think I was then.
Yeah.
When I went to high school, and of course I left high school at age 14 because it was my role to become an apprentice.
Yep.
My older brother was able to go to university. There was enough money for that, but I'm not sure that I had the inclination anyway. I really wanted to get out and do something. I didn't want to become an electrical mechanic apprentice.
Yep.
I hated that,
yep.
But that's all that was available then.
Yeah. And what really got you into winemaking in the first place? Because it's a bit of a jump from being a sparky and then doing the lighting at La Mama and hobnobbing with the Carlton Cognoscenti back in those days and writing restaurant reviews for the Melbourne Times and all that sort of thing. What happened with the leap into wine?
I didn't drink much wine.
No.
So over the time I was in Perugia, I went to England to have a look around and work.
Now, we'll leave you in England shortly and we'll be back after this brief musical interlude. It's Michael Hintz back talking to the ebullient man, Graham Leith. And we left Graham just before the break. He was in England and starting to explain how he got into wine in the first place. Over to you, Graham.
I went to England and I wanted to learn Italian.
Yep.
So I saved up there. I worked long hours in England, like 60, 70 hours a week on construction sites. And I saved enough money to go to Perugia for a three-month course in an Italian language to the Italian, the Perugia Università Stranieri for foreigners. And when I was there, I drank some ordinary wine. And then there was one place we went to, little
taverna
restaurant.
Or, yep.
And they had magnificent wine. And it was just wine that I'd never tasted anything like before. All the complex flavours and the tannin, and it was really wonderful. And we used to go there once a week and look forward to that. And then one night we went there, and the wine that was served to us in the decanter was decidedly ordinary. Mm-hmm. So we asked where our normal wine was, and they said, well, the barrel's finished. So that got me thinking, how come one wine... And they said, this wine that you're drinking now comes from the vineyard next door.
Yes.
So I thought, how can one wine be so sublime and the one next door be so ordinary?
Mm-hmm.
So I went up there on my Lambretta with my girlfriend on the back, and we to the hills above Perugia.
The Lambretta is a scooter, people. It's not a gun, so don't get carried away.
And we sampled the wine from both
those
places. And the people who... made the good wine, allowed us to buy a few bottles. They normally didn't sell bottles.
Right.
Just kept them for themselves.
Mm.
And then much later I read that that little area of Perugia is quite famous for some of the wines. But whether they were made, what grapes they were made from, I don't know.
So that got you started. Now, winemakers I found, and I've interviewed one or two in my day, and it still is my day, we're not that old, edgy and restless in the pursuit of the holy grail of making the perfect wine, which, of course, is the journey. It's never achieved. The vigneron in you must be acutely aware that you're only as good as your last vintage.
That I might?
You're only as good as your last vintage.
Absolutely. And every vintage is a challenge to see if you can do better.
How many vintages have you done all told now?
Well, the first one was 79. First commercial vintage was 80.
Yes.
And you would have tasted that at our vineyard in 82.
Probably, yes. Yep.
And that was... we opened a bottle of that a while ago. It was still drinkable. It was like an old fruit cake, but it wasn't off.
Yeah,
it was just fruit cake.
It was just fruit, yeah.
Beautiful.
Raisiny.
And the 81. Mm. So I've been making every vintage since then. This one looks very interesting, Michael, because it appears that it'll be the Pinot Noir at Musk will be a month ahead of last year.
But they're saying this everywhere. On the Mornington Peninsula, it's been getting earlier and earlier, and the yields have been getting less and less, making it more expensive.
But a month earlier than last year, and last year was 2 weeks earlier than the year before.
Something's happening. Is that called seasonal and climate change? Is that...
I guess climate's changing. I mean, the Roman warming, they grew olives in the Rhine Valley, and there are traces of them.
Yep.
And in the medieval warming, they grew citrus and grapes up to Hadrian's Wall.
Yep.
So it was warmer then, and looks like we're heading that way.
Mm. And now the Poms are producing sparkling wine, and they're going bananas about it, and they think it's going to rival the French.
Well, why not?
Why not? Good on them. Tell me about your 2013 Pinot Noir, made from fruit grown by your old friends, the McKernans at Coldstream, very fashionable at Coldstream, you know. You need your Range Rover there. Pardon me, but in the Yarra Valley, it's no shrinking violet at 13.8% alcohol, is it?
Well, Cameron picked that. That's the last time we used the fruit from McKernan's, unfortunately, because the whole Yarra Valley's been raided for phylloxera affected. Now, it was a terribly arduous job for us to go down. We had to crush the fruit down there and bring it up in sealed containers to Kingawa. It was very onerous. So we've still got a lovely, friendly relationship with the McKernans, but we can't use the fruit anymore. So now we make two Pinots, the one called the Fools on the Hill. That's made from our vineyard at Musk.
Mm-hmm.
So we make a Chardonnay and a Pinot Noir from there,
and
they're both barrel-aged, very expensive, very top-quality oak.
Yep.
And they're our premium ones. And then we make another Pinot, which is very good. And that's from a couple of different vineyards around the place.
Yep.
But not the Yarra Valley anymore.
Yes, now, you've got to be a bit of a Don Quixote to take on Pinot. You've really got to have... you never really get on top of it, do you? It's the wine winemakers fall in love with, but they also tear their hair out and lose many nights' sleep about, isn't it? Great.
Well, I was lucky in that I was able to... I'd always been fascinated by the possibility of making some Pinot.
Yep.
And I was fortunate, because a friend had a property at Narre Warren East, and I was able to use the grapes from that. And I had
Is that near Reg, where Reg Egan would have been?
Where?
Reg Egan, remember Reg Egan from the...
No, I don't think so.
Hmm.
Well, No, I'm not sure where he was. I thought he was more in the Yarra Valley. This is just over. It's a bit cooler than the Yarra Valley.
Yeah, right.
So I made two wines from that and put that in a show. I made a reserve and a standard, and that was called Three Wise Men. I put a new label. And that just won gold, half a point off a trophy, which just got edged out by Lindsay McCall, but that's to be expected.
Oh, Paringa Estate.
And then I got a silver with the standard one.
Yep.
So that caused people to scratch their heads a bit. How come this bloody Graham Leith, who makes full-bodied Shiraz and Cabernet from Bendigo, how come he's up there? He's got two medals for Pinot. So that gave me great satisfaction, Michael.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, there must be some connection between music, because you've said about when you're making vintage, you're a little like a conductor assembling all the pieces of the orchestra through vintage. Take us through that analogy.
Yeah, well, the noises are one thing.
Yep.
You know, the noise, the roaring of and as the press deflates, there's a huge roar like a bassoon.
Yep.
And then there's a clatter of other things as the grapes are being destemmed. There's a clatter, 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 and then it's music to my ears too, because it means the wine's getting made. We're getting on with it. We're getting through vintage.
Are you reading the book, you come through as the quintessential Aussie battler. Does that make you feel good, someone saying that? Or I prefer to say a sort of Don Quixote down under of wine. Tilting at windmills.
Tilting at windmills.
You're not, well, the characteristic, when I read your book, the subliminal message is that here's someone that has a go, that's not afraid to express an opinion, has a go, and puts absolutely everything into it.
Yep.
Is that a fair summation of...
I think that my training as a tradesman helped me a lot in that respect, because you mustn't give up. You must patiently and laboriously work through any job until it's properly done. And I think...
Is that a trait inherited by your sons? Have they got that same...
He does very much. Mm-hmm. One of them.
Which one?
Cameron, who makes the wine.
Yep.
Two of them, Jesse and Cameron, used to come across that stage. They were living in Dalesford, and I was still working the property at King Gower. And they'd sometimes come up with my wife, their mother, and Cam would go straight into the winery and roll up his sleeves and say, right, what's to be done? He's about six.
Yep.
And Jesse would go over to the tasting room and print out the takings.
Yep.
So Jesse is now more concerned with sales.
Yep.
And Cameron more solely concerned with winemaking.
That's fair enough, because it's one thing to make the wine, it's another thing to get it to market in a crowded, as you know, and you know more than many. Look, I must recommend a great book to you. Have you heard of the book Bypass, The Story of a Road? We're jumping around a bit here, because you've spent probably more than most people time traversing the Hume Highway, back and forward to
the
tastings.
Colder, not the Hume.
Well, no, but the Hume in the old days, and then the Calder. Yeah, the Calder Highway. Well, you might have crossed the Hume anyway.
Yep.
If you like highways, there's a really good book about the Hume Highway. It's called Bypass, The Story of a Road by Michael McGurr. You'd love it. Might be about the Hume, but the humour and the tales could be equally applied to the Calder.
The Hume Highway normally means to me that I'm going up the Snowy Mountains trout fishing. So
yes.
Mind the Hume.
Yep. Now, you've had a few interesting people work at King Gower. You had once as a cellar hand the now very notable Stefano De Peri, didn't you?
Yeah, he used to come up and work with us weekends. And, he'd cook. And he was always amazing in that he used to, enjoy working in the winery. But it was always autumn, so the garden was always a bit ordinary, pretty worn out. But he could just nip out to the garden at the backyard and he'd come back and he'd be able to make a fantastic little dish out of the bits and pieces, a couple of old eggplants.
In other words, he was a forager.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
And and I'm actually going. He conducts a tour of Italy.
Right. Oh, and you're going on that?
Every year, and I'm going on it this year. I thought, why not? Because I saw the television. I saw Assisi and Cubio.
Yes.
On the television, and I said, Stefano's tour is going there. And I've always said I'll go back because I used to go out there from Perugia.
Right. Have you been back since? How long is it since you've been to Italy?
No, never been back since Mille Novecento Sessantuno.
Oh, well, that's translate that, please. A long while.
1961.
Yeah. What, are you going soon this year? Or
October we go. And another friend of mine, Dougal McClellan, is an art historian.
Right.
Is going to teach us all about the artworks as we tour around these various galleries and churches and things.
I envy you. Look, the Italians have got not only good food, but to me, they really embody the art of hospitality, don't they? Mm. La tavola, the long table, and the, you know, that's why a lot of the Italian families who settled in the Riverina after the war have done so well, because they've stayed together through tough times, and they really just know how to show you a good time, don't they?
Yep. Yep, I love them. Hospital. Well, there was a couple in the cellar door the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend who's got a new restaurant in Melbourne.
Yep,
he's just setting up, and his parents were up. So of course we were singing. They were having a meal with us at the cafe, mm-hmm. Musk, our place, and. So we were singing all these old Italian songs, Marina, 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 and so on. And everybody's just having absolute ball.
And we've had a ball this morning. And, Graham, I'm going to have to wind you up because it's almost time and the time has just flown. Graham, thank you for your time today, coming all the way down. It's been a pleasure talking to you and very much appreciated. No guest next week as it's vintage and our winemakers are flat out, but Graham's been able to tear himself away. However, on Saturday the 9th of April, my guest will be Adam Carnaby, who was, or is, chief winemaker at Seppelt's. Great pity about Treasury closing the winery at Great Western. Never mind. Anyway, that'll be on April the 9th. My research material was sourced from Passing Clouds, A Winemaker's Journey. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia via the Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.